to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Now, what is Across the Movie Aisle, exactly? Here is the elevator pitch. It's left, right, and center by way of At the Movies. Indeed, one of the working titles of this show was Left, Right, and Whatever. Alyssa, a Washington Post opinion writer, being the left, of course. Me being the right. And Peter, the features editor of Reason Magazine, constituting the whatever. Whatever you people believe. Alyssa, Peter, and I have been friends for years now, despite existing on disparate corners of the political quadrant map thing. You know that thing. We met on the wilds of Twitter, occasionally doing a bit of ideological jousting, but it wasn't until we congregated in the cozy confines of press screenings for movies that you people love and that we love, that we realized that movies did more to bring us together than to tear us apart. That doesn't mean we agree on everything, of course. You'll see that today. Indeed, one of the joys of our friendship is finding the ways in which different movies appeal to or disgust us in different ways. Having a true diversity of viewpoints on hand to work through what we've just watched helps us see the world via different perspectives and appreciate the artistic efforts we've just sat through more thoroughly. One of the goals of Across the Movie Aisle is to expose you, the listener, to just this diversity of viewpoints. Think of us like an ideological buffet. You might not always like what you taste, but at least you're broadening your cultural horizons a little bit. Before we get started on this week's show, I wanted to tell you all a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com, one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll enjoy some of our originals, the Rebeller originals. Check out S. Craig Zoller's discussion of his favorite graphic novels, or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin's tribute to Sally Menke, the steady editing hand behind Quentin Tarantino's rise to prominence. We're paying people good money for the content you're enjoying right now and on the site, and we hope you'll sign up for a membership. For a limited time, you can lock in our introductory annual rate, $20.19, for the next 100 years. That's right. For the next century, your subscription rate will never go up, ever. As the editor-in-chief of Rebeller, that's my promise to you. I will honor that rate even when I'm 137. That's 100 years from now, in case you guys were wondering. Alyssa, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Peter, how are you doing?
I'm great.
First up is Controversies and Nontroversies, a segment in which we weigh in on the day's hot-button issues and decide if they're worth getting agitated about or not. Nothing is more hot-button than Joker, the new movie from Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix about the titular clown prince of crime's origin. We'll get to the movie itself in a bit. What I'd like to focus on here is the coverage of the film, which strikes me as borderline scandalous. First off, you have critics, even the admiring critics, suggesting the film might cause violence. As Robbie Collin, whom I quite like, put it in The Telegraph after the film's debut at Venice, part of me thinks the movie should be locked in a strongbox, then dropped in the ocean and never released. Collin later stirred up headlines when Phoenix exited an interview after the critic asked if the filmmakers bear some responsibility for potentially inspiring violence. Then there's coverage of a letter written by family members of victims of the Aurora, Colorado mass shooting, in which they suggested Warner Brothers should atone for releasing this film by fighting for gun control, by giving money to all the gun control groups and buying some, you know, what do you call them? Indulgences. Some political indulgences. This round of stories propagated the myth that the shooter at that shooting was dressed as the Joker, that he'd been inspired by The Dark Knight. This, of course, is nonsense. It's an urban legend. It just won't die. And finally, you have headline after headline about police presence at theaters ramping up, despite no credible threats and warnings by the military that, well, something could happen on a military base showing the film. Maybe there's incels out there. There's clown cells out there. They're calling themselves clown cells. Clown cell culture out of control, folks. Out of control. So at a certain point, we have to ask the difference between covering a film or reviewing a film. And I think there are lots of different ways you can do that. You don't have to like the film. Some of the people in this room don't like the film. And inadvertently rooting for violence. I really do think contagion killings are real. And the press is this close to sparking one with all this nonsense. So I have to ask Alyssa, do you find the coverage of this movie so far to be a controversy or a non-troversy?
I find it a controversy because it's making me hate everyone involved in the coverage of the movie, both the people who are involved in making the film and the people who are doing the coverage themselves. I think it's incredibly important to stick to the facts in cases like these. And over again, mass killings have been blamed on specific media. And there is little to no evidence that anyone goes to see a movie and then says, oh, that looks like a great idea. I'm going to go shoot someone in the face. That's not a thing. Sometimes mass killers borrow stylistic tics from movies that they're fond of, but that's a very different sort of vector of influence. I'm also furious at director Todd Phillips, who has, you know, turned this into this self-pitying media tour that it's just exhausting. I mean, he's going around complaining that, like, he can't be funny anymore. He can't say daring and edgy things anymore, even though he got $55 million to make, you know, what's sort of a difficult movie. And so I think the press coverage has been not helpful, with some exceptions. I thought Vox's Alyssa Wilkinson did a nice job of sorting through some of the questions about how to judge a movie like this. But I also think that the folks involved clearly stand to profit some by turning this into a conversation piece and have leaned into that in ways that make the discourse dumber.
I think blaming the filmmakers here is totally unfair, because what is happening time and again is that they're sitting down for these TV filmed interviews, and someone's like, how are you going to feel if somebody gets shot at one of your movies? You know, what responsibility do you bear as the filmmaker for what happens after the film comes out? I think that is not only unfair, but I think it is actually potentially dangerous.
Oh, I totally disagree on the question of whether it's unfair. And one thing that constantly baffles me about the entertainment industry is that no one seems to figure out how to do this, the kind of basic level prep in this sort of not even crisis PR situation. There is the easiest canned answer in the world to that question, which is, one, all of the evidence suggests that these kinds of movies don't actually spark mass killings. Here are all the cases where you think they do. In fact, none of it was true. All of this has been debunked. Second, this is an examination of this kind of violence and its roots, but it portrays its main character as someone who is miserable and not someone you'd actually want to emulate. I mean, I could make so much money doing this kind of very basic stuff. And look, if Todd Phillips wants to be, he can be controversial and, you know, brave in quotation marks, or he can be universally adored, but you don't get to wander around about how you complaining about how you can't do comedy anymore, making fallacious comparisons to, you know, the incredibly stylized John Wick movies. And you can't be both a martyr and beloved of everyone. You don't get to have your cake and eat it too that way.
I think the real problem here, or a real problem, is that Todd Phillips could never make comedy. The Hangover movies are just incredibly awful and unfunny films.
This is actually slander right now. I think what you are doing is slander. The Hangover, the first Hangover in particular, is actually deeply funny and weirdly dark, and that's one of the reasons I thought he could succeed in making this film. Why he does succeed in making a very good film.
They are simplistically cruel.
We'll get to that in a minute. But Peter, I do have a question for you. Do you think that the filmmakers will bear any responsibility if somebody goes out and commits an act of violence? Does depiction equal endorsement?
So I don't think they bear primary responsibility for the actions of somebody else. If somebody decides to shoot up a movie theater, if somebody decides to shoot up a Walmart, if somebody decides to shoot up a music festival, the person who is responsible for that happening is the person who does the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very clear line we can draw. At the same time, I didn't like the movie very much. I don't like the way that Todd Phillips has handled talking about the movie.
Uh-huh.
And I think he bears responsibility for his movie. For mm-hmm. the movie that he decided to make, mm-hmm. and for what it says, what it doesn't say, and for the ugliness that is built into his film.
Well, again, we'll get to that in a second, because I'm more interested in the way that it has been covered. And one of the things we were discussing before the press screening, you and I, was this idea of contagion killings, yeah. and the empirically demonstrated connection between
sure, when you see press coverage
right.
of mass shootings spike, you tend to see clusters of mass shootings. It's one of the reasons that you see fewer of them, not none, but fewer during, say, election years or right around September 11th, is because the press was covering other things.
Mm-hmm.
And, or I should say, there appears to be there's a pretty strong correlation. Maybe not because, but there's a pretty strong correlation there. At the same time, I think it's a little bit hard to say the media has some direct and primary responsibility. And in fact, mass shootings are news. And it's really hard to say.
If there was a mass shooting, right. I would agree with you. If there was a mass shooting, but instead what we are getting is piece after piece and story after story with like, oh, this movie's going to inspire the wrong sort of person.
I've argued, you know, just to continue this thought really quickly, I have argued that the press should think about what they can do proactively when it comes to mass shootings, that one of the things they can do is to downplay some of the coverage. At the same time, I recognize that if you are a newsroom editor who is making decisions about what's important in America and what matters, it's very, very difficult to say, hey, somebody just murdered a large number of people. Let's put that on A19 rather than A1.
Totally agree with you. What, I 100% agree with you, but this is
very difficult to make some of
this decisions. This is a totally different thing because there has been no violence. I don't know. Alyssa, what were you going to say?
I think that one of the things that's been tricky about all of this lead-up coverage is that it's based on some level on sourcing in the military and law enforcement, right? I mean, you have this army base that sent out a warning to service members about the possibility of violence at the shooting, at the screenings. You have police departments in major cities saying that they're beefing up securities, theater chains doing the same thing. And so it's not like this is something that has been invented out of the whole cloth by journalists. But I do think there is a problem in that entertainment journalists who are writing about this movie and about the brouhaha around this movie are not necessarily also equipped with the investigative skills to figure out why police departments are doing this, to really fisk whether there is intelligence here. So you have a sort of mismatch between reporters and story, right? And I think it is interesting. You know, some of it could be legal liability for the theater chains. I mean, if you are a movie theater, you do not want a repeat of the Aurora shooting because you don't want people to stop going to the movies. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be sued because there's insufficient security. And so maybe there's risk here, but it's risk that's being calculated in other ways.
Well, I mean, I also think the movie chains just don't want to see people shot.
Yes, well, sure, of course. Sure. But I mean, I also wonder if there's an extent to which this is, from law enforcement's perspective, intended to be sort of an act of deterrence, being like, if you were thinking about doing this, we are going to be ready. You will have less of a chance of getting out uncaptured, alive, et cetera.
Very rarely want to be captured.
Yes.
But
it's a weird situation, and it's a weird combination of, you know, developments, statements by government agencies, and a press corps that is not necessarily trained to report out the veracity of this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, and a press corps that also lives and breathes this stuff and understands its relevance in a way that is frankly just different from how normal people relate to it. If you are an entertainment journalist and that's how you make your money and that's your living and you spend all day talking about movies and thinking about movies and seeing movies and writing about movies, then movies are your world and they have a huge and outsized importance in the way you relate to the world. I would say they have an outsized importance in my own mind because I spend a lot of time thinking about movies, but I recognize that most people who are going to see Joker this weekend just don't. And I think that there's a sort of a mismatch in terms of thinking amongst entertainment journalists in that regard as well. It happens with the political press, too.
My parting thought on this, and I'm curious to get your guys' take on this, is that this feels like something we do every 10 to 20 years, right? Like, I would say that the coverage of Do the Right Thing, when you have people like David Denby saying, this movie's going to cause riots, you know, that's irresponsible. I think it's irresponsible. It's unfair to the film. It's unfair to the filmmakers. And it's unfair to the audiences, frankly. It treats them like idiots or easily impressionable or whatever. You had the same thing 20 years ago when Fight Club came out at Venice. You know, people arguing about whether or not this was going to spark violence and whether or not this was going to, you know, be a rallying cry for the disaffected males of the world. This is very much a thing we see from time to time. And I find it very frustrating. I don't know about you guys. I find it very frustrating that we have these same fights over and over again, and nobody seems to actually put any historical context into any of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right that it's frustrating. I also think that, you know, part of what's happening here is we are in a cultural, political moment where people have successfully, in terms of advancing their agenda, made the argument that what happens on screen has a real world impact, that, you know, adequate representation of women and people of color has a tangible effect on the self-esteem of the people who see those movies, et cetera. And so it's hard to establish a percent to which movies are causal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you buy into that argument that there is a real world impact to what people see on screen, and I think to a certain extent there is sometimes, I mean, in terms of people, you know, thinking what's possible, people feeling comfortable with people who are not like them, but it's very hard to quantify that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if Joe Biden came around on marriage equality because, like, he liked watching Will and Grace, you know, that's a tangible impact mm-hmm. of pop culture. But it's hard to quantify the extent to which someone's attitudes are shifting over time and the extent to which a specific piece of art becomes a trigger for action. Mm-hmm. And this conversation lacks a lot of that kind of nuance, which I think is important.
Can I just sort of add another factor in here? What frustrated me most about this discussion was that it wasn't about the movie and it couldn't have been about the movie.
Yes.
All played out a full month before any normal person, normal moviegoer was allowed to see this. In fact, even many movie critics, we didn't see it until the week that the movie was scheduled
for.
The week the movie was scheduled for release. And so there's this huge kind of controversy, conversation playing out amongst, you know, 200 people who have seen the movie. It really actually reminded me you mentioned Do the Right Thing and Fight Club, but it reminded me a lot of Zero Dark Thirty, where David Edelstein wrote a review calling that movie borderline fascistic, and like you saying was, you know, sort of an apology for the Bush administration's torture program,
which I think could not be more crazy.
Right, I thought was a very bad reading, but it took weeks before we could get in to see the movie.
Well, because what
even if you were a movie critic,
what ended up happening was Glenn Greenwald wrote a series of very long Greenwaldian pieces where he bases his entire reading of the film on this review, and he says, well, it doesn't matter if I haven't seen it, this other person has seen it, so I know what I'm talking about.
It doesn't serve viewers.
What we're supposed to do as journalists
and as critics is our job is to serve readers and viewers, and you don't do that when you conduct this super elite, sort of high-level discussion about a movie that no one could have seen.
This is a festival problem, and it's a conversation we can have at another time. I think festivals are actually actively deleterious to the film
the film discussing
community.
I think it is.
The discourse is not aided by that. But no, this drove me. I'm glad you brought this up, Peter, because it drove me totally bonkers this week. This idea, this constant harping about what a movie might do to people when they eventually see it. It just is condescending. It is so disrespectful to the mass of audiences who you look at them and you're like, oh, well, look, these idiots will go shoot anything up. You know, you put it, you know, how do we protect them? Protect us from them? I found the whole thing really distasteful.
There were a bunch of people online today who got very mad at a David Brooks column for inventing a flyover country's Trump supporter. And, you know,
conversation with flyover man.
Independent of my opinions of that David Brooks column.
What cultural
critics who were kind of saying, well, this movie might cause violence, were doing was inventing
100%
inventing a moviegoer that they were having a little mental conversation with in their own heads, and then saying, wow, that person might get crazy if they saw Joker.
Right, this guy's crazy.
You don't need Joker when you have Elliot Rodger. Like, you just don't.
I don't understand. Who is Elliot Rodger?
You don't know who Elliot Rodger is?
No.
So Elliot Rodger is the perpetrator in the Isla Vista shooting, who published this like lengthy, insane, like incel manifesto.
Oh, was this the train wreck guy? Was that the train wreck shooting? Oh no! I'm sorry. I know who you're talking about. I know who you're talking about. This is we haven't used his name at all. This is one of the things that makes me very happy about kind of the coverage of these shooters is I actually don't know who this person is.
But he has become enormously influential, and his manifesto actually literally has been referenced by a bunch of other mass shooters. And so, these ideas can spread, but they are clearly spreading independent of this movie.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's just weigh in once and for all. Is the coverage of the movie Joker, not the movie itself, just the coverage of the film so far, a controversy or a non-troversy, Alyssa?
Controversy.
Should have been a non-troversy, but is a controversy.
It is a controversy. It's controversial, dang it. All right.
Shouldn't be.
This brings me to the film itself. Joker tells the story of Arthur Fleck, a mentally ill individual living in a Gotham City that resembles the hellish New York of Taxi Driver. He wants to be a comedian, but he isn't funny. It's a real problem if you want to be a comedian. And the world has no interest in letting him be anything other than a piece of human trash. Given the title of the film, we can hardly be surprised when he goes a little bit mad and starts killing people. Despite one big misstep near the end, which we can get to in a moment, this is going to be a spoiler-filled discussion, people. All of these discussions, very spoiler-filled. So if you haven't seen Joker, you don't want to be spoiled, tune out now. I've already got your download. I thought it was a wrenching and chilling and, yes, very provocative picture. Leave aside the oppressiveness of the atmosphere and the suggestion of a world careening off the rails, Warner Brothers has made a $50 million movie in which it is suggested that Antifa killed Thomas Wayne. Peter!
And thus created Batman?
And, doesn't thus, that make... and thus created the Batman. Peter, what did you make of Joker? My understanding is you loved it. Please.
Yeah, your understanding is incorrect here. So I found it actually tremendously well-crafted. I don't quite want to say gorgeous, it is, but it is a phenomenally moody film, and it captures a certain sort of urban grit and the sort of the despair of living in that in a pretty effective way. And Joaquin Phoenix is really effective as the title character. He has just stripped himself down and sort of become this kind of weird wire puppet creature. He physically seems almost subhuman, which is part of what the movie is about, is sort of how people see him as less than human, and therefore that drives him to become a murderous maniac. I really didn't like the movie, though, and I didn't like it actually for some of the same reasons that I don't like the Hangover films, which is that I found it fairly shallow and fairly cruel. Mm-hmm. And there's just not a lot there. It's a sort of surface level look at this character, and it just says, well, he got made fun of, and then he started murdering people, realized that either he didn't care, or maybe even that he liked it. In fact, I would say even more what it says at the end, and this is, I think, maybe the thing that I liked least about the movie, is that when you get to the end, what it basically says is murdering people, becoming a maniac, a psychopath, gave him power. And it doesn't really question that. Mm-hmm. It just says, this made you powerful. Now, it doesn't say it's good. Mm-hmm. I don't think Todd Phillips is out there saying, well, Joker is killing people, and actually that's kind of awesome. But it says it made him powerful. And that's, I think, a really sort of fundamentally, it's just an ugly message for a movie. And if you look at the reference points, the two big reference points here for this movie are Taxi Driver and King of Comedy.
Yes.
And what both of those movies do really well is they let us understand that Travis Bickle, that the De Niro character in King of Comedy, these people are not just deluded and sad and pathetic. They're wrong. They're doing something that's sort of out of place in this world. They let us see the negative impact that they're having on other people around them, in particular the female characters, even though these movies are not about primarily those female characters. They're letting us understand that these people are invading their space and doing something that is creepy and more than disruptive.
One question for you, Peter, before we move to Alyssa. In your reading of The King of Comedy, is the final montage in which we learn that Rupert Pupkin has become a best-selling author fantasy or reality?
In my reading, I think it's there isn't a clear answer there. If it's fantasy, then because, you know, we see so many of his fantasies mm-hmm. throughout the film, that makes it, you know, you can read it that way. But if you want to read it as reality, I don't think that is a... an argument that, oh, this made him successful.
If he's a best-selling author with TV appearances and whatnot, how is it any different than what happened with Joker, who, at least by the end of the film, Joaquin Phoenix is locked up in a mental institution? He has been punished and imprisoned.
Take De Niro's character away at the end of King of Comedy. And I would just say that the upbeat finale is... either a fantasy or it is an indictment of the media environment that he exists in and the and what it rewards.
Well, this is also the end of Joker, very much. Alyssa, you were... I know the exact moment the movie lost you, and I could see it coming about 2 minutes before it happened, is when Joker stabs the larger clown in the eyeball with the scissors.
Yeah, and
you're not a big fan of stabbing violence. And as soon as he picked those up, I was like, oh, Alyssa's not going to like this.
No. I mean, So I've been seeing movies with you guys for a long time, and often I'll ask one of you. I have an actual phobia around eye damage. I don't like stabbing violence. And so I've gotten pretty good at asking one of you to just tell me when something I know is coming that I cannot watch because I will get sick is coming on screen. And Peter did that for me this time. But the thing is, what lost me about that scene isn't actually that there's a really vicious stabbing. It's what happens afterwards. And so in this scene, two of Arthur's like clown colleagues have come to visit him to let him know that the police are looking for him in connection with these three shootings of, you know, Wayne Industry finance bros who somehow know a lot about musical theater, but I digress. And so Arthur responds by viciously stabbing to death one of his friends.
Who betrayed him.
Yes.
It should be noted that he was a bad clown.
But he also gave him the gun that he used in the shooting. Right. In any case. And the other guy who's there has dwarfism. And when they came in the house, you know something bad is going to happen because Arthur slides the chain in the deadbolt. And so he kills the bigger guy and tells the guy with dwarfism that he can leave. But he goes to the door and he, of course, can't reach the deadbolt. And it's, you know, it's really vicious. And the audience, a lot of folks burst out laughing. And it could be a nervous release of tension, but to me it also suggests that for at least half the audience, Phillips has not landed the mark there, right? I mean, you're laughing at this guy who is in such dread and terror, who is being like abused based on his disability. It's just really vicious.
But this is a joke straight out of the Hangover films. And it's, I mean, it actually reminds me a little bit of the bit, and I believe it's Hangover 3, where they're driving with a giraffe in the car and they run into a bridge and the giraffe just loses its head. And right, so you're like,
I haven't seen the third one. So
and it's probably funnier in my description. It's not funny. It's just sort of like, wait, we're supposed, like, there's a giraffe that due to these characters' idiocy has now died completely pointlessly. It is a kind of there's a shallow cruelty to his work that I just find really off-putting, and I find it neither entertaining nor funny.
So I actually did find the scene where the dwarf couldn't get out of the apartment kind of funny, but it is also
you're the problem.
But
here,
it is 100% a nervous release of tension because you are. I mean, look, here's the real problem with that scene from my perspective is that Joker should have killed him too. Like, this is it's of a piece with the rest of the movie where bad people are punished by the Joker. Everyone who he kills is a bad person, with the exception of maybe the social worker at the end of the film. I don't know how we want to read the bloody footprints coming out of the room, but everybody in this movie is somebody who has wronged him in some very specific and often very very harmful way, right?
Yeah.
And so this is my problem with the movie, at least insofar as if Todd Phillips really wanted to go full bore with this, if he really wanted to be like, here's a man who's been pushed too far and society will now pay for it, the other parts of society have to pay for it. It can't just be the bad people.
Well, and it stacks the deck, right? I mean, it makes the killings look, if not good, justified.
Yes.
And I just think it's a movie that, I'm not opposed to making movies about scary people or about scary men. I mean, I don't know if the two of you have read or watched We Need to Talk About Kevin, which is...
I have read and watched.
Yeah, it's...
I had my kids first, thankfully.
Yeah. I mean, so that's a... I mean, that is a novel and then a movie about a woman who raises a son who ends up becoming a mass killer. And it's really unflinchingly grim, but it's also really beautifully executed and calibrated. And this movie, I think, is sort of iffily executed. I think it's really well lit. The cinematography is nice. The score is so insanely pretentious and over the top.
It's a horror movie score. It is a, like, Freed can ask, like, deep...
But for me, there are just these
sort of thing.
Big calibration problems, right? I mean, one of the things that I think I and a lot of other women who have watched this movie have noticed and felt really strongly is the way that it handles female characters, right? And let's set aside Arthur Fleck's mom, played by Frances Conroy, for a minute. He has, over the course of the movie, interactions with four different Black women. The first is his social worker after he is released from the hospital for a beating he suffers early in the movie, who he sort of complains is dismissive and not really helping him. There is an African-American woman on the bus who accuses him of sort of bothering her son. There is his next-door neighbor, played by Zazie Beetz, who is not actually ever named in the film, but who he has this sort of fantasy relationship with. And then there's the Black psychiatrist at the end. And the movie is sort of iffily calibrated about those interactions, right? It's sort of on his side in terms of the social, in the scenes with the social worker kind of early on, sort of.
I would say the only place it's really on his side is the scene on the bus with the mom who tells him to leave the kid alone. That you feel bad for him because he clearly can't control himself, and like the little kid initiated the interaction. But I think that with the social worker in particular, I thought that was actually a very sympathetic portrait of a woman who's clearly like being drowned in work and not supported by the city, and like is in over her head.
I mean, she has those
except
lines.
He gets this weird revenge on her that's totally unwarranted, totally unjustified.
What weird revenge?
He kills her by proxy at the very end by killing the psychologist or the psychiatrist. Who
at
he's
well, we
to.
Don't we don't
at Arkham.
We're not sure.
It's strongly implied, but the one of those interactions that feels sort of properly calibrated to me in terms of like showing you how unnerving this character is and like how hard women are having to work to manage his emotions is the twist when it's revealed that his, you know, relationship with this neighbor is a fantasy. And in this really uncomfortable scene, he comes home late at night, comes into her apartment, and she comes home and you realize she doesn't know him at all, right? She's, you live down the hall, right? And she is so frightened. She asks him not to hurt her. And then said, you know, is there anyone I can call for you, right? She immediately has to go into that mode of caring for him because it's the only way that she'll protect herself. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment for me where the movie actually most resembles Taxi Driver, which...
Also, king of comedy in the sense that it's the one moment where we see that there is a fantasy life that is distinct from reality, right. Which is a big part of what King of Comedy does.
Well, and I had not seen Taxi Driver until a couple weeks ago because I grew up largely without access to media and, you know, filling stuff in piecemeal. And everyone talks about Jodie Foster's performance in that movie. But to me, almost the more interesting one is Sybil Shepherd's. She plays Betsy, this campaign worker who Travis Bickle gets infatuated with. And the movie does such an incredible job of showing you how Betsy is trying to manage Travis. So she gives him enough of what he wants that he won't hurt her or explode. And that is just, it's a much bigger part of that movie, right? I mean, her trying to manage him and, you know, sort of to just not set him off. That's a big thread throughout the movie. Here we get like one scene of that. Mm-hmm. And then it's back to like, haha, you know, killing Black women is liberation at the end of the movie. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the implication is fairly strong. That
the movie doesn't side with Travis Bickle.
No.
The movie makes it pretty clear that Sybil Shepherd's character is the one who is being put upon, the one who is being asked to go, who is being made uncomfortable, who is being asked to do things that are sort of beyond her, that she just shouldn't be made to do because this guy is actually really messed up. And mm-hmm. so it is a way. It is on the one hand like an attempt to understand Travis Bickle, the De Niro character. It's not like, oh, this guy's just a monster, we're going to dismiss him and make fun of him. It's very much the opposite of that. On the other hand, it manages to do it without making him into a hero, without taking his side, and while recognizing that this guy is deeply a creep in a way that that doesn't make you powerful or interesting, but captures feelings that a lot of people have.
I think the suggestion that this movie doesn't make the Joker look horrible and creepy and awful, there's a difference between you can empathize with him and feel sorry for him and still realize that he is a monster. Like, I don't think there's any, there's no reason you can't do both of those things at the same time. Now,
the movie is in awe of him. The movie,
no, it is not it in is, awe
it
of is, him.
Again, I'm not saying it treats him as good, but it treats him like a lot of Reddit commenters treat mass shooters. Mm. It looks at him and says, "Wow, that guy is really awful. He's evil. Isn't it impressive how bad, how spectacularly successful he is at being the kind of evil he is?" And you know what? Like, sometimes I feel like that too.
I think this is an overreach.
Again,
I think
it's not justifying what he. It's not justifying him. It's not encouraging people to take after him. I'm not saying that there is any direct connection between between movies and acts of violence. But what I am saying is that there is a sort of culture of like, wow, those guys, they really they got the kill count up, man. And there is a, it's not even always without recognition that that is evil to do. And yet there is an awe that is expressed at mass shooters and at the character of the Joker in this movie that I just find repulsive.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's also just something very insular about the movie, right? I mean, it invokes New York in the 80s. It specifically invokes both the initial narrative of the Central Park Five and Bernhard Goetz's shooting of a bunch of teenagers of color on the subway. Like, it's incredibly specific about that. But it is also very careful not to talk about race in Gotham at all or suggest that race is part of Arthur's worldview, even though so many of these interactions involve Black and Latino people. Mm. It's just like, it's...
I thought the class stuff was more interesting, frankly.
Yes.
And I think in a way more sloppily handled. The movie ends with a clown rampage across the city where literally Antifa, like people holding resist signs,
yes,
and calling Thomas Wayne a fascist.
Yeah.
You know, the billionaire savior of the billionaire would-be savior of the city. He wants to be a politician, he wants to run for mayor. They're calling him a fascist. I mean, the connections between Antifa and the clown people could not be more conspicuously made. But they don't really do any. He doesn't really do anything with it except to to kind of use that signifier and that marker.
And in a weird way, the subplot that connects Arthur to the Waynes kind of undercuts that, right? Because there's this ongoing thread where his mom says she used to work for Thomas Wayne and she's been writing him for help to try and get them out of their terrible apartment. And Arthur discovers at one point that Penny thinks that Thomas Wayne is his father. And rather than this being a story about someone who was like loyal to the family and was just sort of cast aside because they're just an employee, it becomes this sort of tangled thing about whether or not she's crazy and having fantasies. And it's just, I mean, yes, you see the resist signs, you see the sort of populist stuff, but while Phillips, has shaded in all of the old signs and, bags of trash, he hasn't shaded in any of the city outside of Arthur's like clown warehouse and a Wayne Industries bank facade.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have to move on here. We should just say once and for all that Antifa are clowns. That's the lesson here. So Alyssa, you're a big fan. Peter, you're a big fan. I'm a big fan. That's three thumbs up for Joker. All right. Now we turn to assigned viewing.
I'm actually cutting off my thumbs so that you cannot.
I'm too late. It's already been totaled up.
You cannot make use of my thumb.
I'm going to send this clip to the Warner Brothers. Now we turn to assigned viewing, the segment of the show in which we discuss what you need to watch to make sense of the movies in the weeks ahead. Alyssa, what's on tap this week and why are we watching it?
We are watching Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, his gorgeous martial arts movie released in 2000. And we're watching it because next week sees the release of Ang Lee's Gemini Man, which is an action movie, although not a wuxia movie, starring Will Smith and Will Smith as an aging hitman and his younger clone. And
the Jerry Bruckheimer produced Gemini Man, I think. I feel like this is a like something somebody has gone back in time to 1996 and stolen a pitch deck for a movie and brought it to us. I really like it.
It's amazing. And Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is useful to watch for this, both because you can see what Lee can do as an action director. And The sword fighting scenes and just fight scenes in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon have always sort of been the bar for me about how you do visually gorgeous stuff that drives and expresses character development, while also just looking really awesome. But it's also a story about sort of trying to reconcile your current self with your past self, or your current self with your future self, because it's built around this trilogy of characters. It's Li Mubai, this martial arts master played by Chow Yun-fat, Yu Shulian, played by Michelle Yeoh, who is both a very talented martial artist and runs like a private security and shipping company, and Jen Yu, played by Zhang Di, who is this young aristocratic woman who has parallels with both Li Mubai and Yu Shanli, and is trying to sort of find this place for herself in an aristocratic life that she doesn't actually want. And so I am sure this, you know, it does not have anti-aging technology, but it's a very interesting look at sort of the dynamics that define a bunch of Li's work. And also just, it looks cool.
Speaking of anti-aging devices, Michelle Yeoh has looked the same age now for 20 years. I was watching the movie and I was like, wow, she looks exactly the same. She looks exactly the same now as she did in Sunshine and as she did in this. So she, whatever she's doing
she
in that shipping
and
company.
Paul Rudd.
Whatever, man, whatever she is shipping.
Are actual the, vampires.
I hadn't watched this movie in a bunch of years, and I was struck by the same thing that I was struck by when I saw it the first time, which is that I actually don't really like that kind of moon bouncy rooftop.
The wire foo stuff.
Wire foo stuff. I like a lot of wire foo stuff, yeah. But that movie in particular, and some of the, you know, some of its similar movies. It feels ungrounded in reality in a way that I find displeasing, as opposed to like The Matrix, which is ungrounded in reality but with rules.
So we should
kind of make it more sense.
The fight choreography is done by Wu Ping, who also did the fight choreography on Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill. Mm. And there's so it's The Matrix, it's Crouching Tiger, and it's Kill Bill are sort of a set of films that he worked on
about a five-year stretch
in the United States. And there's a bunch of overlap and in the way he handles all of those fights. This one is the most sort of Crouching Tiger has more of the kind of traditional wuxia, however you pronounce that,
wuxia?
The traditional wuxia, like sort of lack of gravity to bind people, right? And it's not just that they can like jump high and do flips that no human could actually do. It's that they can just sort of like bend their toes and then suddenly they're whooshing over the rooftops, right? And there's not like a sense of like, oh, I had to exert a whole bunch of energy and like get my arc exactly right.
Well, and in fact, things are often most beautiful when they're sort of effortless. Like there's this scene that is a sword fight high up in a bamboo forest.
Yeah.
That is,
it's so gorgeous.
It's so beautiful. But part of what is really interesting about the scene is that Jen, who has stolen Li Mubai's sword, is exerting this kind of ferocious effort. She's angry and moving a lot, and she's losing. And Li Mubai, who is completely calm and contained, emerges victorious. And so, I mean, it's action very much sort of guided by the spiritual principles that are at work in the movie. But it's also just, I mean, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is one of the first movies that made me love movies. It's one of my favorite movies. And it's so, watching it again was fun just because it's so many movies in one, right? I mean, you have this incredibly silly comedy where Jen has stolen the sword and is running away and is like fighting a bunch of guys in a tavern and just making absolute mincemeat of them. And it's basically slapstick. You have this sort of sweeping and hashtag problematic romance where Jen runs away in the desert and is abducted by a sexy bandit.
And the movie basically turns into a Western for like 30 minutes right in the middle of the movie.
It's awesome. Yeah.
Something out of Monument Valley.
Very hot and sexy Western.
It's an extremely hot and sexy Western.
You're telling me The Searchers isn't hot and sexy? Come on.
But it just, it's this kind of virtuosic and yet really emotionally intimate movie. I think it's great.
It's really a contrast watching that a couple days after seeing Joker and seeing how engaged with the with a female perspective, Ang Lee is in this film versus how engaged Todd Phillips is in Joker, and sort of how much of the movie revolves around, how much of Crouching Tiger revolves around questions of what does it mean to be a woman in this society? And it's, well, here's the expectations, here's what you want, here's what's available to you, here's what it will cost you if you ask for more. And that it is enforced not just by a bunch of patriarchal dudes, though it is sometimes, but also by other women. And it is a discussion amongst women about what it is that they can and should do and what their limits are or shouldn't be. And part of what's interesting is that, you know, that Western sequence and then the Chow Yun-fat character. So you have, on the one hand, you have that slapstick scene in the tea room or the bar or whatever. That's like, here's a bunch of idiot dudes who did not understand what they were going up against. But you also consistently have men who are not made out to be idiots. And in fact, part of what one of the ways that the movie makes the female characters powerful is by the men basically thinking at first, well, this is a competent woman, and then being even more impressed by the fact that they're even better than they thought, right? And so we get a kind of we see how good they are at what they do through a male character who we are already meant to understand is quite competent at his job. And so there is that, right? So it like manages to balance this without just being like, and all of these men are just kind of patriarchal idiots who don't really understand. And this is entirely, you know, sort of a question for women to ask on their own. There's really kind of just a fascinating gender interplay, both in the combat and in the dialogue.
I was glad to revisit this just to get a reminder that Ang Lee has liked to play with film technology and film styles. You know, you have some now obvious kind of green screen work that doesn't quite hold up, but also all the great wire work. The interesting thing about Gemini Man, and this is true also of his previous film, Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk,
Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk,
that nobody saw, and nobody saw because the studio dumped it because he shot a bunch of it in high frame rate, which is a weird technology that I don't particularly care for. But he has used again in Gemini Man, and I kind of want to see it because he makes a compelling case that you need for the de-aging technology to work and for the kind of 3D effects that he is going for. To work, you have to see it in the high frame rate. I don't know if we will. I don't know if anyone will. Nobody actually seems equipped to do it. It's like harder to see an HFR movie than it is to see a 70mm movie these days. So I don't know. But I was glad to revisit it, even if it's not. It's definitely not my favorite movie. Like, it is yours, apparently, Alyssa.
It's high up there. And I mean, to go back to what you were saying, Peter, it is very interesting to see it after Joker, because it's a movie about people not getting what they want and what they do instead, right? And sometimes they're not getting what they want because society says that they should be married off at 18
and then they get all twisted. She literally becomes a bandit and starts marauding around the town stealing swords and getting into bar fights and stuff. She gets twisted, Alyssa. She's Joker. She's Lady Joker. All right.
But also, I mean, the two main characters are people who are in love but feel incredibly constrained by society and moral obligation and don't lose their minds, and in fact like do other people a lot of good. And so, you know, emotional repression is one of Lee's constant themes. I'm sure we'll see more of that here, but yeah, it's I needed palate cleanser this week, and thank God Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon exists.
I'm just excited for the eventual actual remake of Joker with an all-female cast.
Lady Joker.
Lady Joker is going to be...
We have a Birds of Prey trailer out.
Yeah,
guys.
That looks terrible.
Oh boy, yes.
All right. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. If we don't get them, Paul Newman's gonna have my legs broke. And if you didn't love it, just complain to me on Twitter. I love hearing from strangers who hate the things that I do. My handle is @SunnyBunch. Alyssa, what's your handle? Tell the people.
@AlyssaRosenberg.
And Peter, how can people get to you and tell you how wrong you are about everything?
I'm @PeterSuderman, but I'm right about everything.
No, I'm the only one who's right about everything. And I will convince you that I am right about this being the best show on your podcast feed if you send me a tweet. Okay? All right. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.